Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're learning more today about how those controversial new guidelines on mammograms came about and how surprising new ways of understanding breast cancer helped sway the scientists on the panel. For instance, the thinking that some cancerous tumors grow so slowly they may never need to be treated. Of course, that raises the question, how do you know which tumors those are? Gina Collada covers science and medicine for the New York Times. She wrote about all of this in today's newspaper. Gina, it's fascinating but also confusing, as all of this has been. But I want to get to one point first that I know you want to make as well. This has become so political. But this panel started this research, what, back in 2007?
I think it actually started, it decided to do this review in 2006, and it had completed, it actually had everything done by 2008, before Obama was elected, actually. And it may have been, you know, if McCain had been elected, people would say, I guess, maybe it was his plan.
Having the same argument, but this was long before the current health care debate, and it was just a periodic review. And we understand, you talked to panel members, they turned to some researchers at the Oregon Health and Science University, hoping to find missing pieces of the puzzle for them. What were those missing pieces?
Well, what they wanted to do, when they periodically all their guidelines come up for review, and they have to ask, is there new information? And they asked the people at Oregon to tell them what had come up if you look at all the world's literature on mammograms for women in their 40s. And what had happened was one study that had been going on for a while had gotten some more updated data, and another study, a gigantic study in England, had been completed, and it was the first and only study that actually started everybody at age 39 or 40 and followed them for 10 years. In other studies, people started like 40, 45, 48, and you say, wait a minute, you know, they're going into their 50s. Are we really looking at mammograms in their 40s? So this was a giant study, and they said, let's add this in. Let's see whether this changes anything in our picture of the benefits and risks of mammograms for women in their 40s. So that was one of the things they did.
Well, the most astonishing, the most astonishing thing you write about is a new understanding of cancer itself, how it grows or even regresses. In fact, a member of the task force told you that one way of looking at cancer now is as three different diseases, one that grows so fast early diagnosis is useless. There are, of course, cancers that can be cured if they're caught early. But then there are cancers that grow so slowly, they may never be a problem at all in a woman's lifetime. Of course, that immediately made us ask, in reading this, how do you know which is which?
That is a huge problem. This thing about these three kinds of cancers, that's been coming up more and more in recent years. And it looks like every kind of cancer where people look, they find that phenomenon. The problem is, as always, they don't know how to tell yet which is going to be dangerous and which isn't. So one of the risks you take if you have early diagnosis, and it's a known risk with every kind of screening test now, is that you're going to be finding things and people will say, you have cancer, and it is cancer, it looks just like cancer, but you would be better off if it were never found because it's going to grow so slowly that you would never know it was there.
But how do you, will they tell you that? In other words, will they know?
They don't know.
Yeah.
And with prostate cancer, what they suggest to some people, but almost no one does it, and it's very well known in prostate cancer this happens, that they grow so slowly, they say to some men, why don't we just do what they call active surveillance? We'll just keep on seeing what's happening with you, and if it starts to grow, we'll do something. But most people say, it's cancer, I want it out, even though the consequences of getting it out is not so great either.
So what do we conclude from this? You just got about a minute here, that it seems like more information for women as they decide what to do. The White House and others have come forward and said, keep doing what you're doing. But it sounds as if maybe not immediately going to surgery, but keeping an eye on things might be a part of the recommendation.
I don't think they're ready to do that yet because they really don't know which is which. There's a lot of research going on trying to figure out what are the signs of a cancer that's going to be deadly and what are the signs of one that can be left alone and untreated. But that's kind of difficult because most people wouldn't necessarily want to be in a study where they would be randomly assigned to being treated or not depending on if their cancer looks like it's not dangerous. But that is the future. And maybe if they could actually distinguish between the deadly and the less deadly cancers, then screening wouldn't be such an issue because you'd say, we found something, but you don't have to worry about it.
Wow. Gina Collada, a science reporter for the New York Times, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, remember back, a year ago, when it seemed a given that Wall Street would be re-regulated, that banks would be required to have much more cash on hand to back up risky deals. Those derivatives and credit default swaps, which no one understood, would be more transparent. How about those credit rating companies, Moody's and Standard & Poor's, the ones who gave great grades to lousy deals and were paid by the same companies that put together the lousy deals, not to mention executive pay packages that encourage CEOs to make a quick hit and duck the consequences. Oh, and the small print and credit card contracts. Where are we on all of this? Well, with us is Maryland University of Law Professor Michael Greenberger. Michael, you argued when you were in the Clinton administration for more regulation, especially of those financial instruments like derivatives. You lost the debate back then. You say that people still don't understand how toxic some of these instruments became. So just give us, first of all, an overall. Where are we today on regulating them?
We thought once the meltdown happened, that would be a no-brainer. But as we sit here today, it's hand-to-hand combat between a huge army of lobbyists for banks and large corporate interests versus essentially a group of volunteers that are trying to represent the American taxpayer.
Well, let's remind ourselves some definitions of the things you just spoke of. Securitized mortgages, these were mortgages that were lumped together, and that was to spread the risk. The problem was a lot of bad subprime mortgages were in the mix, and then they were sold as these derivatives you speak of, which a derivative is like betting on the future worth of an asset. And then companies began selling insurance on the derivatives, only they didn't call it insurance because they wanted to avoid regulation. They called them credit default swaps. This helped create this toxic mix you speak of.
Yes, and basically I think many people, I'm included among that population, believe that the credit default swaps were the real enemy of the American taxpayer here. Essentially, it was thought to be a kind of insurance allowing Wall Street to take the very riskiest bets. That is essentially to bet on the proposition that people who did not have appropriate credit would pay their mortgages. Wall Street invested big time in that, thinking that they were insured against the losses through these so-called credit default swaps. The problem was the people who were issuing the credit default swaps in this unregulated environment didn't have adequate capital to make good on the insurance. And so they came up short. The poster child is AIG. The poster child of the ultimate rescuer is the American taxpayer. We've had to make up the difference.
So where are we today? There are House proposals with Barney Frank heading that effort up, Senate proposals, Senator Dodd at the helm there. What's being proposed to regulate these derivatives and credit default swaps?
Basically, everybody agrees that there should be a general rule that these kinds of products should be traded on publicly transparent exchanges so that everybody knows the volume of the trading and what the price of the products are and who's doing the trading, and that in that process, if you make a commitment to, for example, insure something, you have adequate capital to back it up. The problem essentially is that the banks and the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable and even the American Petroleum Institute are in there arguing for loopholes that swallow that general template of regulation. And unfortunately, as the bills came out of the House of Representatives, they had two massive loopholes, which essentially well over 30% of a multi-trillion dollar market were no longer covered. And that's a very conservative figure. It's probably much higher than that.
Well, help us understand this, because some have argued that there's this need for exemptions for some industries, that, for instance, some industries need to make these kinds of futures bets. For instance, trucking would need to be able to bet on the price of oil through these derivatives. And that's what we're hearing, that's why there are some loopholes for some industries.
The notorious loophole that's been talked about is the so-called end-user loophole. And that is to say, people who have day-to-day business concerns about hedging their risk somehow shouldn't be required to use the traditional exchange format. They argue that it's too expensive for them to do that, and they want exemptions. Unfortunately, while everybody recognizes there can be limited exemptions for certain specific needs, the remedies overshot that and essentially gave the banks what they want, which are wholesale, wide exemptions that you can drive a 767 airplane through.
Well, David Moss of Harvard Business School feels he might have a solution. He says, okay, let's say you have this public exchange where there's going to be transparency about these trades. Companies should be required to have a huge collateral or a significant collateral to be on that exchange. In other words, as you say, they have to have cash to back up their bets. And he says that Congress should just require that everyone else do the same. In other words, if companies get through a loophole and aren't on the exchange, they should still be required to have that collateral.
Well, that's exactly the problem. These companies are arguing that collateral is too expensive, that if they have to put up the collateral, they'll have to lay off workers, and we will aggravate the jobless rate. My answer to that is it's penny wise and pound foolish. If we'd required exchange trading of derivatives, I think many of us believe the meltdown wouldn't have happened, and we would right now be in an economy that's quite successful with traditional unemployment rates in the neighborhood of 4 or 5%. So these companies are essentially arguing, don't make me pay a penny, and I'm arguing, yes, well, you're going to end up losing a pound. If we don't insist that these companies make these kinds of payments, we're just going to have further joblessness and further bailouts by the American taxpayer.
What about credit rating agencies? Bloomberg's Roger Lowenstein is one who says these agencies who are supposed to tell us what these financial instruments are worth should be paid by disinterested parties, not by the companies that they're rating.
There's no two ways. He's absolutely right about that. Anybody would understand if you're paying your professor for your grade is going to be better and not an objective assessment of your knowledge. And that's exactly what's happened with the credit rating agencies. They went off the deep end, giving AAA ratings to junk status because they were being paid by those who needed the rating. We need to disaggregate that relationship.
Is there any move on that?
Yes, there is a move on that, and I have more hopes in that area than I do in some others. The fact is the credit rating agencies don't have as powerful a lobby as the banks have, so it's more likely that the American taxpayer will get what he or she needs.
Let's move to the Consumer Finance Protection Agency. This came out of Barney Frank's committee. Where are we with this agency? It was said to be created to really hold lenders and credit card companies feet to the fire. Critics felt it was watered down.
Well, on that front, I believe that we've got a pretty decent resolution. It's not perfect, but it's good enough. And if we can get that through Congress in present shape, I believe we have something to begin working with. And I think when it's up and running, it will prove its worth by fighting the battle of making boilerplate and incomprehensible contracts that we sign for credit cards, loans, and other credit-related transactions much more comprehensible and much more fair to the American consumer. So on that front, I'm not quite as worried.
We're getting an update on proposed financial regulations with University of Maryland Law Professor Michael Greenberger. When we come back, what about CEO pay? Banks too big to fail? More after a break, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're sorting through proposals to regulate the financial markets with Michael Greenberger of the University of Maryland School of Law, also a veteran of the Clinton administration, where he argued for more regulation of Wall Street. Michael, let's turn to banks. Congressman Barney Frank, chair of the House Financial Services Committee, has a bill that would create an oversight council of regulators for banks. So what needs to be corrected, and what's the criticism of that oversight council?
The Oversight Council is fine. The problem is that the House legislation and the White House want to give the major responsibility for overarching regulation against too big to fail to the Federal Reserve. And I would say it is almost conventional wisdom now that the Federal Reserve has fallen down in its job. There are some people who think the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Bernanke, did a good job in getting his out of the problem. My problem with that is, first of all, he didn't identify the problem until the taxpayer had multi-trillion dollars of payments being made into the system. And secondly, I'm personally not even convinced he's on top of the issue right now. There is a major debate about the role of the Federal Reserve actually Senator Dodd's bill gives the Federal Reserve a lot less responsibility and gives the so-called Council of Regulators more responsibility. I think that's the direction in which we have to go. Frankly, the Federal Reserve is far too opaque and far too hard to oversee and has been engaged in too many sleight of hand tricks with trillions of dollars for us to be putting a lot of faith in that agency. And I think a further signal about why that doesn't work is the banks are fully in favor of having the Federal Reserve be the ultimate regulator. And I think that's because they feel they can better handle the Federal Reserve than more independent regulators.
Well, one of the criticisms of current regulation has been that banks can shop around among regulatory agencies till they find one that they like. And is it your thinking that this new proposed oversight council of regulators might stop that?
Absolutely. I think there in Congress right now is a lot of concern. And I think you saw it in a House vote last week where they voted for a high level of transparency in the way the Federal Reserve does its business against the arguments of the Federal Reserve and the Obama administration. The correct answer is the answer that Chairman Dodd has offered in the Senate, which is to weaken the power of the Federal Reserve and give more power to the general set of regulators.
You mentioned the issue of banks too big to fail. What's being done on this level to incentivize banks not to grow too big?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think the number one proposal that is being made, and the foremost advocate is Paul Volcker for this, is that we can't let banks get too big to fail. And if we need to, we need to break the banks up. The argument on the other side is, oh, we need these huge monster banks to compete effectively in the international markets. I think that's absurd. First of all, if we'd had smaller banks to begin with, there wouldn't have been the risk that was taken, and the world economy would be in better shape. Secondly, other countries, most notably England, and the director of the Bank of England has the same view that Paul Volcker has. We need to break the banks up.
But how?
Have limits on the kind of business they can do, and also make their capital reserves high enough that they just can't grow willy-nilly and keep merging and buying other banks.
That gets us to requiring banks to have more capital on hand. You say not only will that protect investments, but keep them from growing larger because they won't be able to purchase things as much if they have to hold on to their capital.
Yes. I mean, if they have more capital on hand, it constrains the amount of adventures they can take in terms of taking risk and expanding their base. And quite frankly, we have had since the progressive era in the beginning of the 20th century antitrust laws that limit the ability of large institutions to dominate their markets. And I think that there's absolutely no reason we need to have these monster banks. We should be putting more faith in our community banks and our regional banks. If we do, we will have a much smoother economy. We should not even have discussions over the question of whether someone is too big to fail or whether a bank is too big to fail. Once you start asking that question, you're already in a problematic situation, and the problem gets resolved by the taxpayer bailing these institutions out.
And lastly, executive pay packages. There's a move to legislate that they be voted on by stockholders. Let the market work that way.
Yes, there's a move to constrain executive pay packages. And on that front, I think the American taxpayer is being best protected by the policies that are being developed. And the simple reason for that is the American taxpayer grasps fully the idea that paying people huge amounts of money for failure or for taking risk makes no sense.
So what are the suggestions? Have the pay packages be voted on by stockholders as one, but caps maybe?
Having them voted on by stockholders and having some ratio between the amounts paid to the top officials of the banks and the amounts paid to the rank and file in the banks, or perhaps caps.
That's Michael Greenberger, professor at the University of Maryland School of Law. Michael, your former colleague in the Clinton administration, Brooke Lee Bourne, said she was kept up at night back then, thinking of the havoc that derivatives, unregulated derivatives, were going to create. Of course, then she saw that come true recently with the huge crisis. And she says we're going to have another one if we don't learn from experience, if we don't see this regulatory gap on derivatives. Do you think, is it your sense that we have learned from experience?
No, I'm afraid we haven't. I think even in the best legislation that's working its way through Congress, and I think that comes from Chairman Dodd, there's still a huge $50 trillion loophole in it that the American taxpayer will have to close in the event of a further crisis. Every crisis emanating from the failure of effective regulation of this market comes back, and it comes back worse than the crisis before. And that's why the American taxpayer has to be very vigorous in telling Congress, regulate these markets with absolutely no exception.
Michael Greenberger, thank you.
You're welcome.
And by the way, speaking of which, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll speak with Frontline reporter Lowell Bergman about credit cards and how the men who created the current system on camera can't even understand the contracts they encourage. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, turning old shipping containers into much-needed medical clinics. Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
In Cambodia, closing arguments are underway in the genocide trial of the former Khmer Rouge prison chief, known as Comrade Doik, the first high-ranking member of Cambodia's ousted regime to be tried for war crimes by the UN-backed tribunal. The thousands who died in his prison were among an estimated 2 million people who perished in the Khmer Rouge killing fields between 1975 and 1979. This terrible period of Cambodia's history has been absent from Cambodia's schools, but a new textbook is changing that for young Cambodians. Some can't believe it's true. The BBC's Guy Delana prepared our report.
It's not often that you see students seem so enthusiastic about receiving a textbook. They've come in especially to Sisawat High School in the center of Phnom Penh for a presentation ceremony. School and government officials are formally handing out the new Khmer Rouge history book, and there's also a chance for a question and answer session with the author. The students ask, who were the Khmer Rouge? Why did they kill their own people? The kind of things which one might have thought they would already know, but official information has been thin on the ground.
They have the official text in the government textbooks.
The official text was about one line, wasn't it?
Five lines.
Kamboli D has expanded those five lines to an entire textbook for DC CAM, the Documentation Centre of Cambodia. Like most Cambodians, he was born after the fall of the Khmer Rouge, but says young people mustn't ignore the subject.
After the Khmer Rouge regime, Cambodia is so fragile, it's so damaged, almost everything, even the people's spirit. It's like a broken glass. So Cambodian young generation has the obligation, the responsibility to repair this broken glass. They need to know how their parents were suffered before they can have their parents to heal.
Teaching the Khmer Rouge era hasn't been straightforward in Cambodia. The subject disappeared from the curriculum in the early 1990s when Pol Pot and his followers were among the signatories to a peace agreement. A series of defections and the presence of former Khmer Rouge members in the current government mean it's still a sensitive issue to tackle. So the new textbook is careful to concentrate on the grim facts of the Pol Pot era rather than any political analysis, and that's ensured its approval by the Education Ministry. There are chapters titled Forced Labour, Purges and Massacres, and Interrogation and Torture, but no explicit photos. 17-year-old Rina is among the students exploring the new textbook and looking forward to closing the gaps in her knowledge.
I feel very regret and guilty about this because they killed a lot of many people. This new textbook, I think that it will provide me the experience of Cambodian, and Cambodian will not let it to happen again.
The absence of the Khmer Rouge era from the school curriculum meant young Cambodians had been relying on older family members for information. Some found the horrific stories barely believable. The Documentation Centre's director, Yuk Chang, says the lack of an official school text was part of the problem. He's met many young people who were in denial. Attitudes like that may now change. Im Sao Soka teaches history at Sisawat High School, and he'll use the new textbook to guide his students through Cambodia's bloody past.
I will teach the history of the Khmer Rouge in class, since I lived through this period myself. No other country killed its own people like this. It was a disastrous episode in Cambodian history. If they understand what happened during the Khmer Rouge period, students will change their attitude. They won't get involved with conflict, violence, or fighting with each other.
It's a lot of weight to put on a single textbook, but at the very least, it should help to ensure that young Cambodians have the full details of the events of the Pol Pot era. What happens next is up to them.
That report from the BBC's Guy Delana in Cambodia. And just a reminder, you can always listen to our program stream live at 12 noon East Coast time at our website, hereandnow.org, where you can also download a podcast, leave a comment, send us an email. That's hereandnow.org. Up next, what to do with all those old shipping containers at the end of their lives? Well, how about turning them into health clinics to save lives? In 30 seconds, Here and Now. Welcome back. Recently, outside Boston's Institute of Contemporary Art, a worker drilled holes in a large white shipping container to install a solar panel.
The solar panel will power the solar-powered fans.
Those fans will help cool the interior of the shipping containers, and that's important to Elizabeth Sheehan. Elizabeth is founder of the group Containers to Clinics, which is turning old shipping containers into health clinics to be sent to developing countries where it can get very hot. And where Elizabeth saw in her travels as a trained physician's assistant, there is a great need for clinics. Hers will be made up of two large shipping containers connected in a T shape. One of the containers will have a computer to check patients in. Elizabeth gave us a tour.
I'm standing in what we call container two. There's a pharmacy, and also there's a window where once the patient gets their pharmaceuticals, they come up to the window and we pass the medicine right to them. We'll move into the laboratory. Here we have a microscope where we'll be able to analyze blood samples, stool samples. This is an autoclave, and this is where you put in surgical instruments that need to be sterilized to be used again. We're in the clinical space now. This is an interesting feature. The back door of this container opens fully out to the back. In case there's an emergency, the ambulance can come right to the back of the container, and once the patient is in, the doors can be very easily closed back up. We can lock it from here too.
Elizabeth Sheehan giving us a look at her shipping container clinics at Boston's ICA, and she's now here in the studio with more. Listeners can also go to our website to see photos. But Elizabeth, first tell us more about how you came to this. You worked in clinics in India, in Cambodia. You worked with a group clearing landmines. What did you learn there?
I got a view of what a minefield looked like. It's like a rice field with children walking through it and daily life going on. Mm. But I was hired as the medical director to train the deminers how to take care of their colleagues when they stepped on landmines. There were no hospitals for hours and hours in any direction. There was no clean water. There was no health clinic. There was no doctor. And the children are already malnutrition, so they get sick very quickly. And they die.
You saw things as simple as pneumonia or something that just needed an antibiotic. But
yes,
for the want of an antibiotic, a child dies.
Yes.
When did you connect that awareness of the lack of health care with containers?
I was reading an article in Foreign Affairs magazine written by Lori Garrett, who's a senior health economist.
We know her well. She's one who sounds the alarm about flu, among other things.
Yes. In this article called The Global Health Burden, basically she was laying out the issue that there's unprecedented amount of aid going to global health these days. And there's really very little focused resources going to primary health care and building the rural health care delivery system. And medicine's just not getting to the last mile. So she proposed that you could convert a shipping container for very low cost to serve as a medical clinic in developing countries. Shipping containers litter the world. They're often used once and they sit there.
Yeah. Well, and you said, hey, let's get those shipping containers and make them into clinics, hence containers to clinics. And we understand the first one will be set up in the Dominican Republic early next year. You hope to have 50 within 5 years, 250 across the world in 10. Well, first of all, to cost, I want to just give a little more of your personal story. You grew up one of eight kids. Your mom's family ran a little grain business, which Anheuser-Busch later became involved with, and things worked out rather well there. The family now has one of the biggest beer distributors on the East Coast. But we understand none of your family's foundation money is going to the containers to clinics, and to have them retrofitted to be clinics costs about $100,000 a container. So how are you doing this?
We just finished the conversion of the clinics, and it really is closer to $60,000.
But still.
It's high. To convert the container to where it can be useful in a hot, humid climate, there has been technology used that is a little bit expensive.
Yeah, a lot of
work. So there's heat-reflecting paint. There's an insulated barrier that sort of keeps the heat out, too. But these can be used as clinics for a decade.
And I guess the point is this is a nonprofit, so you have people contributing. But are the host countries going to then also kick in and buy them?
Yes. The Dominican government will provide pharmaceuticals to the clinic. A local NGO will provide some staffing. We're really committed to placing this in a community where the government wants to support it. This is not helicopter medicine. We're not dropping a 7-ton box into a community and 3 months later it'll be non-operational. I've seen hospitals that a donor is given $2 million to and the next year they can't raise that and the next year there's a tree growing out of the hospital. So we want to be very careful so that we do no harm and we provide the highest quality primary health care to women and children. This is the most vulnerable population on earth.
Just one quick question. You know, your first thought is, what a great idea, containers to clinics. There's the container. You fill it with the things it needs and, you know, ship it. But did anyone ever say to you, you know, if you're going to do this, why not just give somebody some money to build a square wooden house and build a clinic?
Yes. We feel that this is one of the ways to deliver healthcare in the matrix of many, many other. And eventually, when the governments get enough money to build the clinic at the last mile, we can move the container to another site, close the doors, and move it 100 miles down the road to another needy community.
That's Elizabeth Sheehan, founder of Containers to Clinics from here in the Dover, Massachusetts area. Elizabeth, thanks so much for coming to tell us about it.
Thank you.
Well, believe it or not, this week officially kicks off the holiday shopping season. We're told this year's must-have toy, the Zuzu Pet.
Wake up, Zuzu Pets!
Zuzu Pets go here and there. Zuzu Pets go everywhere.
You'll love your Zuzu Pets because they're so fun without the mess.
Alrighty, Zuzu Pets are small hamsters, of course. The industry telling us they are the must-have toy ensures they will be. They're so-called smart toys that respond to their environment by scuttling around and cooing. Industry analysts say they haven't seen a craze like this since the 2006 reboot of Tickle Me Elmo. They only cost about $8, but retailers are sold out, and online, people are selling them at a 400% markup or more. That's still only, what, $40? And they have a chance of living. No more hamster funerals, the Zuzu Pet. Well, up next, the film version of Twilight author Stephanie Meyer's novel Full Moon was huge at the box office this weekend. But is she also reversing an old stereotype of Mormons as demonized vampires? We'll take a look at that with a Mormon professor in 1 minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. The Twilight Saga New Moon took in $140 million this past weekend, the third highest debut in film history.
Well, it's Edward. He thinks you're dead.
What?
He's going to the Volturi. He wants to die too.
New Moon is a Romeo and Juliet for the vampire set, written by Stephanie Meyer, who happens to be a Mormon. Now, many have pointed out that the values like abstinence and eternal life with your loved ones that are extolled by star vampire Edward are neat metaphors for Mormon beliefs, but are they also payback?
I am Dracula. I bid you welcome.
That's a scene from the 1931 film version of Dracula, starring Bela Lugosi. Now, Stephanie Meyer has said she's never read Bram Stoker's 1897 novel or seen any of the movies that it spawned, which means she also never saw Trapped by the Mormons, the 1922 British silent movie that cast Mormons as vampires. It was based on a book written by Winifred Graham, who said Mormons were vampire in fact, sucking the blood of Europe with wolf-like emissaries in sheep's clothing, hot on the heels of British womanhood. So, while a fictional account of vampires by a Mormon author may be boffo at the box office today, at the beginning of the last century, Mormons were seen as vampires and almost as vilified. We learned all of this from a colleague who gave us the Brigham Young University academic journal, Mormons and Film. In it, we found the essay, The Mormon as Vampire. It was written by BYU motion picture curator James Dark, who joins us from Provo, Utah. And James, just set the scene for us. It's the early 1900s. Britons were in love with the story of Dracula, the count who came from Transylvania to London, where he feasts on the blood of young virginal females. So first of all, why was Dracula so popular?
Well, you might have to ask Freud about that, but the imageries have been indelible, and they have been so popular up to the current time. I think one reason to suggest the idea was very, very new. The novel was well written, very haunting to read, and was just an incredible story that had legs, as we'd put it.
Well, and other body parts, too. And you set out to show how those images from Stoker's Dracula made their way into anti-Mormon crusades, specifically one led by a Winifred Graham. Who was she?
She was a literary crusader and a novelist who took it upon herself to crusade against Mormons in what was called the first great anti-Mormon crusade in England in 1911. And that's when she wrote her novel, The Love Story of a Mormon, that dealt with this Mormon missionary from Utah who goes to England and preys upon these young innocent women to take back to his harem in Utah.
Now, first of all, was that happening? Were there a lot of Mormons taking English girls back to Utah?
No. Now, we're talking about London, but in a sense, we're talking about Madison Avenue. That is advertising, branding, because she and many others were against this religion, Mormonism, which had practiced plural marriage or polygamy in the previous century, had abandoned it for almost 20 years prior to the time her novel was written. She chose to continue the myth that plural marriage was continuing and that Mormon missionaries from Utah were actively recruiting women into their Utah harems. So she fed on a very popular notion in England at the time, and very controversial, and combined it with Stoker's pervasive image of a predatory vampire.
Well, let's talk about some of the vampire imagery and how it made its way into the anti-Mormon film. Here's another scene from the 1931 Dracula. A villager is telling this visitor from London not to go to Dracula's castle.
We people of the mountains believe at the castle there are vampires, Dracula and his wives.
Aha! Dracula and his many wives. You remember there were many of these women in sort of this trance state that would rise out of their coffins and follow Dracula, hence the analogy to polygamy. What are some other parallels that you see?
Well, there's the hypnotic power that Dracula seems to have over his victims. And in The Love Story of a Mormon, Isolde Keane, the Mormon missionary, puts these women into trances. And he does it to multiple women. And so there's the allusion to Mormons, polygamy, and also this bizarre kind of mysticism that nobody can figure out, but that puts the reader in fear. Well, who are these people? And I don't want them to have this mystic-like power over me.
Here's a passage from Trapped by the Mormons. This is when the missionary is standing below his beloved's window. And, of course, you remember Dracula would always stand below the windows of the women he was stalking before he turned into a bat. And here is what the Mormon missionary says to her. "My sweet one, I had need of you. I was sick with love. I wanted to prove my power to summon you forth. I stood beneath your window and, looking up, called upon heaven to let my spirit enter your chamber. I worked the charm upon my knees." And so
isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, except not true.
Right.
That Mormon missionaries were standing below windows doing that.
There is a parallel scene in the 1931 motion picture. I mean, so powerful is this imagery, where Bela Lugosi just wills Lucy out of her bedroom.
Right. And then, of course, there was the promise that Dracula made to the women of eternal life. Mormons do believe in eternal life.
Yes, indeed. That's a very important part of Mormon doctrine, and that's what makes this so fascinating. The classic Stoker figure of Dracula doesn't want this eternal life. In fact, he says to be dead, to be really dead, that is glorious. Whereas in the Twilight series, this vampire, Edward, wants an eternal life with his family.
Right.
And he wants to turn away from the evil nature that inhabits him. So Stephanie Meyer, in a very interesting trick, twists the whole vampire legend into something that is all about redemption and eternal life.
I'm just wondering, how vindicating is it for Mormons and perhaps film scholars like yourself that she does seem to have turned the tables? First of all, it's a Mormon writing the book that's become this wildly popular film. And the vampire is adored.
Well, it's very, very clever combining chastity with family and eternal life in a vampire story. Who would have thunk, as the saying goes, that this could be done? But that's the stuff of innovating writers.
That's Professor James Dark, motion picture curator at Brigham Young University there in Provo, Utah. His essay, The Mormon as Vampire, appears in the BYU Studies book, Mormons in Film. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.